think this is for me. Thank you, whoever. All right, well, we want to welcome everybody tonight, and especially if this is your first time here with us. Hope you can make it at 7 or so and enjoy some fellowship, and then we usually get started about 20 after or so. We go till about 8:30. We know that people have got to retrieve kids, and if you're not sure where to park, there is a parking lot right here outside this window on my right, your left, and we usually try to have somebody there at the door to let you in. That's a little easier than parking down the hill. If you want to hear any of the prior classes that we've done, we do put all of the notes and audio recordings up on our website and giving you that address there. You can also get them through the church podcast. If you feel led to help us in our offering tonight, participate in offering, that would be a blessing, and we thank you for that. It helps us to defray the costs that we have here, and that famous non-basket bucket is over there at one of the back tables there by Pam and Sasha. Please also make sure that you sign in on our attendance sheet, which is over there as well. That helps us to know who's coming and how many of you there are. I want to thank Sue for leading the class last week while I had to teach in Cleansing Stream. So thank you, Miss Sue. Sue's a great teacher, and she always does a fine job and very insightful job sharing the word. And believe it or not, someday we are going to finish the story of Noah's Ark, but that will not happen tonight. But we're gonna forge ahead in Genesis chapter 8, and reading of verse 1, it says, "Then God remembered Noah and every living thing and all the animals that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the waters subsided. The fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven were also stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained." This is really simply and beautifully put by Moses, isn't it? God remembered Noah. You know that God is a faithful God, and he says to every one of us, "I'm going to remember you." There's going to be a limit to how much that I'm going to allow you to go through. Thank God. God remembers you. He remembers the agreements. He remembers the covenants that he makes with you. You remember we talked about that God had said, "I'm going to make a covenant with you, Noah." And God remembers the promises that he's made in his word. As we'll see later on in Genesis, God swears an oath. Can you imagine God swearing an oath? Going through the formalities of promising to you. God swears an oath. And you know, when we swear an oath, we have to swear by something. But when God swears an oath, the Bible says he can't swear by someone greater than himself, because there isn't anybody greater than himself. But the Bible says God swears by himself, and he has to fulfill his word. He has to fulfill his promises to you and me. So I love that it just simply says God remembered Noah. He promised to protect him, and he accomplished his purposes for the world and his purposes against the wicked in judgment without harming Noah and his family. And so the flood would not last any longer than God needed it to. Moses says now that God sent a wind, and this wind had the effect of stopping the raging of the waves. And so everything begins to become still. So all of the action of the flood that we talked about last time I was with you, all of this massive quantity of subterranean water and from the atmospheric waters is now calming down. And so the process of the flooding is going to reverse itself. There were 40 days of rain and other water. And then it says that the waters prevailed for 150 days over the surface of the earth. Most boring cruise ever. Amen? And those waters continued to rise because of what was coming out from under the surface all that time. But now God puts the brakes on. He's going to reverse that process. He stops that subterranean water and that excess of water that was being released from the water canopy that we said was above the earth in a greater measure in those times. So in verse 3, we see the waters receding. It says, "The waters receded continually from the earth. At the end of 150 days, the waters decreased." They began to decrease. So the waters begin to recede, and it's a valid question, right? How do the waters recede? Another valid question is this: where exactly are they going to recede to? Because after all, at this point, the entire world has been covered over with water again, just like it was at the beginning when we started all the way back in Genesis chapter 1. So if the whole world is covered in water, where can the water go? Good question, right? This is not a problem for God, though. It wasn't a problem for God in the beginning when the world was covered in water then. And it's not a problem for him here a few chapters later. I believe, and I think you will come to the same conclusion, we've got a couple of mechanisms at work here. First, there is obviously evaporation that's going to happen. So we can assume that a lot of the water simply did evaporate back into the atmosphere, and that started a new hydrological system or cycle in the earth, a new cycle in which there would now be rain as a regular feature of life in Earth's environment. And you remember, as we've said a number of times before tonight, rain had not been a feature of the environment up to this time. But now, because of this evaporation, we are kind of kicking into a new type of cycle where rain is going to be a regular part of life on the Earth. And so while there's probably not as much water held in the upper atmosphere as there used to be before the flood, there is still, as we know, obviously a substantial amount of water in Earth's atmosphere, and much of that probably evaporated into the atmosphere from the waters of the flood. But I do think it's safe to say that most of the water that was covering the Earth simply ran off the surface of the Earth. So how many of you know that water is heavy? Right? Water is heavy. And when you have to go anywhere on a trip, when you have to go hiking, when the military has to supply people in the desert, that's one of the biggest problems is the weight of water. A single gallon of water, you may know, weighs 8 pounds. And I think what happened here, because remember, we talked a few weeks ago about the fact that the oceans are a mystery. Remember that? We talked about the fact that scientists don't know where did all this water even come from? It doesn't make sense that our planet even has water. But I think, in fact, I'm pretty sure that God simply allowed, in places of his choosing, he allowed the sheer weight of the water to collapse the Earth's crust at weak places, at certain places. And what happened was this created, because of the weight of that water, created basins that allowed the water to run in and then fill those basins that were created as a result. So I know last week Sue shared with you how the deepest point in the ocean now is some 35,000 feet down. That's about 7 miles. So you could easily fit Mount Everest in there, in that ocean, and you'd still have, you know, over a mile of water on top of it to swim around the top of it if you wanted to. So think about that. So when the Earth's crust would begin to buckle in any significant way, it would cave in those spots. And then those massive quantities of water would simply run off the continents and then drain from the land. So scientists can't explain how the oceans were formed and why they're so stable over time. That's the reason. Before the flood, the surface of the earth was more uniform. So when you just have this massive quantity of water sitting on this uniform ball of earth, so to speak, at some point, it's going to cave in. And once that starts, it's going to start to just have a chain reaction. In fact, the scientists nowadays don't think of oceans the way that you and I think of oceans, you know, 4 oceans or 5 or the 7 seas. They think of it as one big ocean that they call the world ocean. And the composition of it is pretty much uniform all over the world. Anywhere you go, the seawater is the same. So it's really one ocean. It was formed in one event, and this is the event. So the oceans of the world are, in fact, the basins into which this water has poured. So if we go down to the shore, and I really outdid myself this week with all these pictures and graphics, you know. But if we go down to the shore, and those of you that like to go fishing or like to go out to sea, we can see the depth of the water, right, gradually increasing until we reach the end of what is called the continental shelf. When you reach the continental shelf, the ocean truly begins to become what the ancient peoples would call the abyss. So the water remains shallow. And then once you get to about 200 meters, so that's about 700 feet, let's say, it really begins to dramatically taper off. And so the depth of water will go from being a few hundred feet to very rapidly becoming very many thousands of feet. And so you can see this basin effect. So the you've got an average depth of ocean that's about 10,000 feet around the world. But we know, right, when we're close to shore, it's not really that deep. It's a couple of hundred feet. So I attached this graphic for you, which shows a huge canyon that most of us have never heard of. It's called the Hudson Canyon. So how many of you know there was a Hudson Canyon, right? All right, there we go. Now, we've all heard of the Grand Canyon, but undersea canyons like the Hudson Canyon are a lot longer and deeper than anything we have on land. So if you can follow what's happening on this little graphic, you can spot up at the top Long Island and New York City and New Jersey. And as you move away from New York City, you could see that the water remains shallow for quite some time. When you get to where it says Hudson Shelf Valley, that if you can't make it out, that's only 50 meters of water. So it's only about 175 feet of water all the way out to that point. But as we move a little bit farther away from New York City, we see the sea floor quickly starting to slope down until in a very short amount of space, all of a sudden it's over 3,500 meters deep, which is something like 11,000 feet. So you can go out for quite a distance out there in Long Island Sound and way out into the ocean, and the water will only be 50 meters deep, and then all of a sudden you have this drop off. Why? Because that was crushed down, and so you have this basin that goes like this. And then it's interesting, the very deepest part is not in the center. The very deepest part, the trenches, are actually relatively close to land, which is odd, except if you can imagine the weight pushing down like that, you have these deep spots closer to the actual continents. It's interesting. So what happens then? If you can imagine this amount of water that Moses says, and help me out, Sue, I don't remember, how many cubits did it cover? Was it 15 over the top? So the highest mountain was covered by, 20
feet.
Yeah, so 20-something feet, 15 cubits above the highest mountain. So now imagine all this quantity of water running off the Earth's surface. You know, talk about opening the drain, right? And letting the water drain out. So a lot of people that have studied these things, they believe that formations like the Grand Canyon were not carved out over millions of years, but maybe got carved out in just a few weeks, due to the action of this unimaginable quantity of water raging through the land and just having the power. You know how water can change the landscape. Imagine what this quantity of water can do and just scour the landscape to these tremendous depths. So I think those are the two mechanisms that after the flood produced the world and the system we have now with deep oceans and so forth, which really did not exist before, and of course the evaporation. So we cannot be completely sure how it all played out. I will be very interested in heaven to see the videotape. I'm sure you will too. But we know that as a result of the flood or some further catastrophes in the generations that followed, there also began our modern continental drift. Are you familiar with continental drift? If you don't know what that means, that simply is the theory that talks about how the land masses, the continents, are sitting on plates, the tectonic plates that are sliding around above the surface, the mantle of the earth, extremely slowly. And so you get the tension in the slippage of these plates as they push against each other until one plate wins and one plate loses and slips under the other one. That's what creates earthquakes. And so the continents are slowly moving, or I should say, to be more accurate, the plates are moving slowly across the top of the earth. So the example that the scientists give us sometimes is the example of a fruit, example of an orange peel sliding around on top of the actual fruit underneath, right? This is not to scale this image, but can you imagine removing the peel from an orange, right? In one piece. You know how kids would want to play that game, see if they can remove it all in one piece without tearing it. So you could put that piece of orange peel back over the fruit, and you could slide it around the fruit that's underneath. You follow what I'm saying, right? So obviously that's not a perfect picture, but it gives you an idea that the land we're on, we talk about terra firma, but it's not really firma at all very much. So the land that we are standing on, which seems so solid to us, when you take the larger perspective, is actually floating on something underneath, and it's moving around ever so slowly on the surface of the earth. So all of these changes were probably caused by this as well. Now, this is an extremely slow process. This is not something you can observe, just by, nobody ever woke up and said, I'm going to go down to Jones Beach and watch the continents move today, right? It doesn't work like that. Yeah, in California, maybe, with The Rock, right? San Andreas. But the continents might only be moving at the rate of an inch a year, which is really slow. But that doesn't mean that they've always moved at that slow rate. So when we get a few chapters down in Genesis 10, we're going to read about a man named Peleg, who was a great-great-grandson of Shem. Now, Peleg means, his name means division. How'd you like to have that name, right? Don't you feel sorry for these people, a lot of them, That's like, nice to meet you, I'm Nick. Oh, I'm division. That's like, nice to meet you, brother. Please don't come to our church, right? But Moses says that Peleg was named division because during his lifetime, very interesting, the earth was divided. The land was divided. Now, some people say that refers to the languages being divided at Babel, but other people say that it means actually the land itself being divided. So we can't be 100% sure, but it's very possible that in the generation of Peleg, that the continents rapidly were pushed apart more quickly than we see them moving today. We always could see, If you have a good eye, you could always see that you could fit the continents together. And it took a long time for science to admit and realize that, yes, they actually did at one time fit together and form one landmass. The people who came up with that, 150 years ago, were basically laughed out of school. But they came to realize that it was correct. But what I'm suggesting here, based on Genesis 10, is that at some point, for whatever reason, God allowed those things to be pushed apart very quickly. Probably this was another way to separate people, to divide people and isolate them, to break the evil unity that they had at the Tower of Babel, which we'll talk about in a few weeks. So God said, I'm going to divide their languages, but I'm also going to push them a little apart over here, right? So that they can't really get at each other and unite as one human race. We have used technology to overcome all those boundaries of distance and the boundaries of language as well, right? So I have Google Translate on my phone. I can communicate. I could just hold my phone up to somebody's face that speaks another language, and we can understand each other, and we can obviously communicate instantaneously all over the world. So God divided and pushed apart the continents to keep us from getting together. And in the last days, mankind's going to get together despite all of those obstacles that God put in place against us and conspire against God. What a thought that is, right? All right. Moving on at the speed of a glacier to verse 4. Has anybody tried to figure out my ratio? I think I'm going about 8 verses an hour. I don't know. We'll get the conclusion of the book in the millennium, right? Verse 4 says, then the ark rested in the 7th month, the 17th day of the month, on the mountains of Ararat. So we're going to leave aside the discussion of chronology. We're not going to get to that this week, but let's talk about the location of the ark. So a lot of people say, and you hear people say all the time, that the ark landed on Mount Ararat. But this is not what Moses said. What is he saying? Moses said it rested on the mountains, plural, of Ararat. What does that mean? All right, well, first, Mount Ararat, if you don't know, is a mountain located in Turkey, which overlooks Armenia. And it's very significant to the Armenian culture. But in the time of Moses, this name Ararat most likely refers to a territory that was called Urartu in the ancient times. And where was that? That covered the whole land area, which nowadays we know as Armenia and the eastern part of Turkey. Now, I've given you a copy of a Google map there so that you can see the region we're talking about for you people that like geography and maps. The red pin in that map is the location of the actual mountain that is called Mount Ararat. So if you're wondering where that is, that's where it is, right by the Ar in Armenia. So the Bible says that the ark rested on the mountains of Ararat. And really what Moses is telling us here is that God had caused the ark, when the waters began to stop raging, and now we're going to run this process in the opposite direction and dry the earth, Moses is telling you, where was the ark when this happened? It was resting on the water over that region, the mountains of Ararat. So that as the waters begin to go down, the ark is going to land somewhere in that region. And so God designed it so that mankind was going to have his second start, his new start in that region. And so from there, that's where they spread out, and most of them settled down in that Babylon area. So, all right, the million-dollar question then, I know which some of you had already asked me, is do we know where the ark is? Where is the ark? And obviously, well, I should say first, I don't know. So that's my short answer. But obviously, there have been a lot of attempts to find the final resting place of Noah's Ark. And it's a very interesting study. They've made movies, documentary movies. Some of you, if you're as old as me, you remember there was even a movie that ran in the movie theaters back in the 70s called In Search of Noah's Ark. Anybody remember that? Yeah, people showed it in churches and stuff, and it was really interesting. So there have been a lot of attempts to find the final resting place of Noah's Ark. And we have modern scientific technologies, right, like radar and satellite imagery, which have been a very tantalizing development because they have led people to hope, with a renewed hope, that we might be able to find the ark. Where is it? And of course, people are very motivated, right, to prove that the Bible is true. And if you could find, you know, some ancient piece of wood, you know, with the carving in it that said Japheth was here, right, that would be amazing. So if we could prove the existence of the remains of a ship in the mountains somewhere up there in this region, obviously it would be an electrifying discovery, and people would take it as proof of really of something important. Maybe they wouldn't take it as being proof that all of Genesis was literally true, because people would resist that, but of course. But it would obviously be one of the most amazing discoveries of all time. One difficulty that we have in thinking about the ark's whereabouts, and I want to caution everybody, is that this entire subject is full. It is full of frauds and full of hoaxes. Many things that Christians have jumped onto and believed were 100% accurate, a few years down the road, things are ending up in court. People are admitting that they lied. People are admitting that they falsified things. So please, when it comes to this area, be extremely careful, because, you know, money is a great motivator, and there have been a lot of frauds and a lot of half-truths. So that is one thing that creates problems in looking for the ark. The other thing is the confusion that is caused by the idea of what is Mount Ararat, as I mentioned a moment ago. So in recent years, probably the two main things that people have argued about for the past, let's say, 30 years or so, you have two main ideas about the ark. And we could call these ideas the ark in the ice and the ark in the plain, which are kind of self-explanatory. So the ark in the ice idea theorizes that the ark is buried in ice and that it is high up on Mount Ararat or somewhere in the near vicinity. So Mount Ararat is kind of a double mountain system, if you will. There's a big one, and then there's a little Ararat, which is right next to it. And these mountains are extremely difficult. They are extremely forbidding, very dangerous, very icy, almost all year round, very difficult to climb, full of crevices and all, you know, anything that you could think of from an adventure movie, it's all up there and it's extremely dangerous. But there are people who believe that NASA and other space agencies have taken satellite pictures of some kind of anomaly up there and have gone to look. And this is, you know, you can very easily, we live in the age of Google, right? So you can very easily Google, I could have come in here with 40 pictures, but you know, you can go Google these anomalies and you'll see what these pictures look like. There is some kind of a something or other on a NASA photograph, which has a general shape of an oval, which people say that's it, that's Noah's Ark under the ice or something like that. So this is not a crazy thing that people say, but I don't know if it's really provable unless somebody can actually get up there to that exact spot. So people have gone all over that mountain, the lower part certainly looking, and there are lots of stories of people who live in the region, and maybe during some warmer years they have supposedly gone up. And there are a lot of stories like this over the past 150 years of people going up in the mountains and they have supposedly found something, even a ship, they say, protruding out of the ice, something enormous. Some people claim that they've even gone up and stood on the top of it and jumped around on it and so forth. But we have no hard photographic evidence from people who have gone up there. We have some eyewitness stories, but that's it. And as I said, there are many cases of fraud. So extreme caution is called for if you dig into, not to be cute, but it's archaeology, right? I didn't invent that one, please. And there were also said to be complications for many years because you could not easily get there. Mount Ararat is in Turkey, but only just barely. Now, on the other side is Armenia. Armenia is the neighboring country, as I said, but Armenia was part of the old USSR. And so it was part of the Soviet Union. And our old Cold War enemies, the Soviets, the Soviet Union, would not appreciate Americans or Turks or other Westerners poking around on their border or sneaking through their territory. And so, you know, the US and Turkey and others did not want people going up there. So, listen, there's all kinds of conspiracy theories about the Ark. That supposedly Russia and Turkey and the U.S. all actually know what's up there, and they don't want people to know because, you know, they're anti-God or something like that. I think some people think that the truth about the Ark on Ararat is being suppressed because it doesn't match up with what Muslims believe concerning the location of the Ark. So that the Turks don't want to say, well, that's the Ark, we think it's there, because then they're going to say, well, you're a Muslim and you can't conflict with what the Quran teaches us, so that would be a problem. But in any case, people have supposedly brought down pieces of wood and things and claim that it's very ancient. And if it's something there, if there really is something there in that particular mountain, it's going to be very hard to get at. And it may take years more or decades until we have better technology to go up there, because you would be talking about something that has been halfway up the side of a dangerous mountain with accumulations of, with, you know, 5,000 years of accumulations of snow and ice possibly accumulating on it unless something shifts. So time will tell, or maybe it won't, right? So the other idea is the Ark in the plane idea. And this is a newer thing, very interesting, because it came to light only in recent times. It came to light in the 1940s. And very interestingly, only several days after Israel became a nation again in 1948. But in recent years, it's been suggested that the Ark is actually a few miles down the road a bit from Mount Ararat, in this place in Turkey called Durupinar. Now, researchers have found a very interesting formation there, which actually looks like it could match the size and the shape of the Ark. And many people have been convinced by this. So some people have claimed that when you scan this location underground, that there's a lot of metal there. It's a lot of iron. People have said it's the ribs of a ship. And there are also very large stones which have been discovered in this region, which are a type of stone, they say, that ancient ships used to use to give them stability in deep water or dangerous water. So you have these massive stones and you hang them off the ship, and that kind of steadies the ship. It's very interesting. So as you might expect, people will dispute this, but very interestingly, the Turkish government has actually declared this to be the actual site of Noah's Ark. You can go to Turkey, and I just saw a picture of a road sign, and in Turkish it's like, Noah's ship, this way. So this object, whatever it is a little bit over 500 feet long, which would match our size parameters. But a lot of people just say it's a natural rock formation. Even among creation scientists, a lot of them don't believe in it, although some do. And I've given you a picture of that object or rock formation, whatever it is. And I don't know if you can, how well you can make this out. But in the center of that picture there, can you see the outline of what looks like a wall that's going around? So they would say that this was the structure, and that it's been buried under mud, which has kind of splayed it out and given it this kind of burst open appearance. So it kind of rises out of the landscape there. And whatever that structure is, it's about 500 feet in length. Now for scale, there's a little black dot close to the bottom length. That's a man, that's a person in the foreground of the picture. But this structure is 515 feet long. So some people are convinced, they say that is Noah's Ark. And that location, I think, matches better what the tradition was in that part of the world about where the Ark came to rest. So it's kind of funny that the Turkish government says this is the real Ark. It's not up in the snow and the ice of Mount Ararat. And the answer is, for me, is that we just really don't know. I mean, I wonder if God ever will even reveal to us where the Ark is, right? It's very interesting to me that Jesus said that people would not believe his word. You remember the story he told about Lazarus and the rich man. And Jesus said that people will not believe his word even if someone were to rise from the dead. So Jesus points people to the word and says, believe the word, because God, you know, places such a high premium on faith in our hearts. You know, if I asked for a show of hands, probably most of us in this room did not come to faith in God because we had a stack of 100 books to give us evidences for God. It usually doesn't work like that. Most people who come at you with a list of 1,000 questions are not sincere. They're trying to tear you down. Now, there may be some. There are some intellectual people, you know, who are bent that way, and they do come to faith by examining the evidence and digging into it. But not everybody's like that. So I just find it interesting that Jesus said people wouldn't even believe if somebody rose from the dead. So I don't know that God will ever tell us where the Ark is. I don't know that he will. I could be wrong. Maybe it is a part of his end times plan to give us more concrete evidence. But, you know, even when people have evidence that is very convincing to some, other people will always come out and say, well, no, that's a natural rock formation. No, that's not the remains of a nail. That's some calcified stone, right? So you're always, I think, going to have this back and forth, unless you can find something that's much more concrete. Maybe it doesn't have to be a wooden beam that says, you know, Japheth was here, but it's going to have to be something much more concrete. People have been poking around already for a couple of generations with more modern equipment, and it's still inconclusive, and they still cannot agree on the proper location. So I guess time is going to have to be what gives us our answer. So I want to read the next section, and I'm not going to focus on the story, but I'm going to focus on the structure of the story for now, and then we'll dig a little more into it next time. But in verse 5, you start to get the chronology of what happens now, the second half of the trip, from the time that the waters begin to go down. In verse 5, it says, the waters decreased continually until the 10th month. And in the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. So it came to pass at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. Then he sent out a raven, which kept going to and fro until the waters had dried up from the earth. He also sent out from himself a dove to see if the waters had receded from the face of the ground. But the dove found no resting place for the sole of her foot, and she returned into the ark to him, for the waters were still on the face of the whole earth. If you're really scratching your head about that, we're going to talk more about it next week. But the short answer about that for now is, you know, a raven doesn't need to come back because a raven could land on something and eat. All right, so the raven didn't need to come back. The dove would want terra firma, but the raven would not. So this is Noah's smarts to know the habits of all these different birds, right? So he put out his hand and took her and drew her into the ark to himself. Verse 10, then he waited another 7 days, and again he sent the dove out for the ark. And then the dove came to him in the evening. Behold, a freshly plucked olive leaf was in her mouth. And Noah knew that the waters had receded from the earth. So things are starting to grow. The olive, this shows you that people who wrote the Bible were not dummies. The olive plant is a plant that has no problem starting to grow in very wet ground. So, you know, the earth was not completely dry, but Noah knows now that vegetation is starting to spread on the earth. So because the dove brought him back this sign of vegetable life again on the earth. So he waited yet another 7 days and sent out the dove, which did not return again to him anymore. So now there is some land where the dove can start to make a nest and so forth. And it came to pass in the 601st year, in the first month, the first day of the month, that the waters were dried up from the earth. So if you're keeping score, we've already gone about 11 months from the time we started. And Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and indeed the surface of the ground was dry. And in the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dried. So we've gone, we'll look at the timing, like I said, next time, but we've gone like a full a year and 10 days, basically. So it's a long time to, you know, how many of you have ever had, you know, your siblings or your family members get on your nerves, you know, in a long car trip, you know, a 370-day car trip? I mean, that would do it, you know. Now, how many, you know, bottles of beer on the wall could you sing for that, right? Imagine. And we won't have time to look at the story of the birds and all the rest tonight, which is really interesting. But I want you to see something about the pattern that Moses is showing us. The recreation of the earth that God performs after the flood comes to its peak, right? That is a mirror image of how the flood destroyed the earth. So the back half of the story is a mirror image of the front half of the story, because God is pointing us to something. And we have chiasms, what are called chiasms. And so in the Bible and in other ancient literature as well, Romans, Greeks, as well as the Hebrews, there is a kind of structure in this literature that we see popping up all the time. It's all over the Bible, actually. And it's called a chiasm or a chiasmus. Not a chasm. That's something you fall into. Hopefully not. But a chiasm. And you're going to become true Bible scholars tonight. And then the next time you go to a cocktail party, you could say, you know, I was thinking today about the chiastic structures in the first few chapters of Genesis. But once I tell you this, it's going to make some favorite parts of the scripture much more interesting, and you're going to blow your mind as you see some of these structures in the text. A chiasm is a parallel structure in which the story advances to a key point in the middle of the story. So we start our story and we advance to a key point in the middle of the story. Once you reach the key point in the middle of the story or the middle of a verse, a lesson, then the story reverses itself. And the rest of the details are a mirror image of the first part of the story. Now, this was done for a few reasons. It was done for the sake of poetry, but it was really done so that people could memorize the story. You could not just, you know, if we were sitting around the campfire in 1000 BC, you know, you could not say, oh, hang on a second, let me get a notebook and write this down, David. This is really good, right? Because you had no paper. And you had nothing to write with. And you could probably read if you were an Israelite. But if you were not an Israelite, or if you were not a wealthy Egyptian, you probably couldn't read anyway. So you had to use this. The mind and your memory was the key. Do you know that when writing became popular in ancient Greece, Socrates was against it? because he thought that the Athenians were going to lose their wonderful memories. You know, it was a good job in the ancient world if you were a poet, because a poet would travel around for money. He was like a performer, and he would just recite, you know, the Iliad or the Odyssey. I'm talking about a guy's 1,000-page poem. Recite it from memory. So the human mind is capable of tremendous feats of memory, which we do not train our minds to do. But one of the ways that they remember these things like that was by using the structures. See, if you have a book, right, you can say, okay, here's the first paragraph, here's another paragraph, here's a new chapter. Well, what happens if you don't have a book? What happens if you don't have paragraphs? You have to do something with the structure of the text. And so that's why they did things like this chiasm. So they were created to tell the story in such a way that people could memorize the story. If you could remember the front part of the verse or the front part of the passage, then you had already remembered the back part of the passage because it was the mirror opposite. Now, this is a lot easier to see when you grasp it on paper rather than just talk about it. So I want to show you how brilliantly Moses designed this story under the leading of the Spirit, of course. So I'm going to show you them. This is the way they're usually laid out, A, B, C, and then the letters in reverse. So look how this starts. 7 days waiting for the flood, 7 more days waiting for the flood, 40 days of flooding, 150 days of water coming up and prevailing. And then in the middle, we have that wonderful line, God remembered Noah. Now the back half, 150 days of water decreasing, 40 days waiting, 7 days waiting, and then 7 more days waiting before they get out of the boat. Now notice those two things are a perfect mirror image. And if you don't know to look for it, you'll never see it. Notice how those sections correspond to each other, right? Everybody see that? How they mirror each other, A to A, B to B, and so on. And we find these patterns all over the Bible. They're all over the Bible, in the Gospels, in the letters. They're all over the Old Testament. If you know to find them, you can see that they were teaching devices and they were memory devices. Now, that is really a wonderful pattern. It's a beautiful pattern, and it's pretty neat, really. The pattern is actually much bigger than that. The pattern for the whole flood story is one big chiasm, which I'll show you next time. So this is a beautiful pattern, but I want you to notice the key element in the story, because every chiasm has a hinge on which it turns, and the hinge here takes us back to where we started tonight. If you study this pattern, obviously you will see that the Holy Spirit is drawing our attention to one key thing, and the Holy Spirit and Moses are showing you what is the key to this entire story. It all hinges on that one thing. God remembered Noah. So personal. Everything in your life story hinges on that as well. When God comes into your life, when you have that moment when God comes into your life, you will begin to see him unwind and take apart and reverse the situations in your life that sin got you into, that caused you to get into trouble. And then, just like Noah, you will have a fresh start. So I love that the hinge of the whole story, the hinge of the whole narrative, it all pivots on those three words, God remembered Noah. And that's beautiful and that's powerful. So next time we get together, before we finally get out of the ark after 370 days, we're going to talk about the chronology of the flood, and we're going to talk about those birds and what goes on there. And then if we have time, we're going to talk about how the human family started over again with Brother Noah's crazy mixed up family and all the many grandsons that he had that spread all over the world. So we'll leave it at that. But we do have a few minutes. I can take some questions. Yes.
Life, even when floods of like happen with the sea life, they actually die because of the way the water takes the sea life. So, and Noah didn't take any sea life with him on the ark. So when the oceans formed, how do you think, God just put them there, put sea life there to?
I'm sure a lot of them did die. I'm sure that a lot of them were killed by the action of the flood, but a lot of them were not. I mean, there had to be some marine life. I mean, the earth was not completely lacking in lakes and seas and so forth, but it was nothing like, you know, really like we have now. So I totally agree. I totally agree with what you're saying. I'm sure there were a lot of things that were killed. And that's probably what our friend the raven was eating. So Noah knew he didn't come back. I really don't think there was still a cow, you know, floating up there after 5 months. So those guys became fossilized by the weight of that water, probably. So, but that's a really good question. You know, there's some people that believe that that when these things happen, that a lot of these creatures, some people say that that's what the Loch Ness Monster is. It's like a big leftover guy that when things shifted around, he got stuck. He no longer has an outlet to the ocean. I'm not saying I believe that. I'm just saying that's the theory, because that some of those lakes, like Loch Ness, is incredibly deep. It's like well over 1,000 feet deep. And so something left over and huge could be in there with no longer having any outlet to the ocean because of how things formed. So who knows? Maybe they'll find that someday too. I don't know. But yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. In class, you were talking about the recesses that the water went into. Could it not be like seismic activity? In other words, the earth, the land was pushed up, and at the same time, you know, you could have had like lava or whatever evaporating water that was beneath the earth, you know, and pushing it out.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the idea of the mountain formation. Yeah, because we know that the mountains were, there were definitely some upward thrust of mountains as well, but we just, if we look at it from the perspective of creation, we really don't know how it happened. You know, seems unlikely to me that that's happening over millions of years. So, you know, so I think you're onto something there too.
No, I mean, just it's a event, in other words, like,
right,
like this. Let's say there was some magnetic shift in the solar system or something that create, you know, made the earth push up, you know, and then these oceans.
Yeah,
out.
Yeah,
that like
could
a counterbalance to what happened at the flood.
Absolutely.
Like that could happen.
Yep. And I absolutely agree with that, because we don't know what all the subterranean activity was. Most of the flood water, I believe, was the subterranean water in the first place. So, you know, the mechanism could have been, you know, a body traveling through the solar system that just triggered something because of a huge gravitational impact on the Earth. I mean, we just don't know, you know, we just don't know. But that's very possible. You know, God had done that in the first go around. You know, and He caused that land to come up. So, but we think that at that time the land mass was one mass and the surface was more uniform. So somehow it got patchy. So there's a lot of water and not a lot of land. You know, I mean, 70% of the earth is that ocean. But it's interesting. Michael.
Yes, I have two questions. First one is, that 40 days of water, the polar is covered, they go up, and they land, I guess, in an area of which Noah was aware of, right? Instead of going outside the world or something else where you would get out and like, I have no clue where I am. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just interesting. I think it's odd, interesting that somewhere you could say, hey, you know, I've read this, at least I've heard it, seen it, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That's one. And the second thing is, you mentioned, like, you know, how, lack of a better word, cool would be to, you know, actually find the art, whatever form, wherever place. And I always think that the most astounding thing to find, personally, would be the Garden of Eden. You know? And then I think, well, wouldn't it be a Garden of Eden still with the flood and everything? You know, did they have to guard it during that time? So I'm just throwing out random thoughts.
Yeah. Okay, well, those are good thoughts. The first, just for the purposes of the tape, I'll just repeat what you said. But first question or thought is about the movement of the ark. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. If we're starting out, who knows where we're starting out? I mean, are we starting out, you know, down by the Persian Gulf? And, you know, no idea, because we don't even know what that area even looked like then. So was he down? Was it on the position of the globe? Was it down by what for us is India, or was it down by Kenya? Was it somewhere around what we think of as Israel? We don't know. And I have no idea how far it would travel in that situation. I don't know how much wave action there would even be. If you have the whole, I mean, because you don't have tides, so, I mean, who knows? You know, a lot of this, obviously, and I freely admit this, I mean, a lot of this is just, we're speculating, because we just don't know. I always like to preface this kind of discussion by saying that I believe it's a supernatural mechanism. Did God use natural means? Did God make a rogue planet fly through and mess up our gravitation or whatever? Yeah, maybe. But there's no way to know. So we're speculating. So we just don't know. And I have no way of knowing myself, probably without reading a stack of books, you know, what you know, smart, you know, PhDs in hydrology would say about how far did the ark travel. I just don't know. As far as, what was your question about discovery of... Oh, the Garden of Eden. Yeah. Well, it's interesting that God had posted a cherub there, right, to guard the way to the Tree of Life. So I have to assume, since nobody's been slaughtered by that angel lately that I know of, I have to assume that the flood, the destruction of the flood, took away the need for that. So I think the original is lost. A lot of people think that the description, because of what, and we might have talked about this back in the spring, but the description that Moses gives of the rivers and stuff, I mean, a lot of people would place the garden somewhere in the area of what for us would be, you know, between, let's say, Yemen and the big rift valleys down there in Africa. So somewhere around that rift valley area, people think that that's where that was. And there's interesting locations and things in there that would correspond maybe with those rivers. But, you know, when Moses is talking about those rivers, one or two of those rivers, I think at least one of them, we have no idea where it was. Or, you know, if Moses says Euphrates, okay, well, that's Euphrates as Adam knew it. You know, does that mean the same thing as what the Euphrates means to us after the flood? Who knows? So I don't really think there is such a place. I don't think it can be found. I think there was probably an angel keeping people away from the Tree of Life until the time of the flood. And then, like I said, there's no more need for that because it was all washed away. So it's my opinion. I mean, there's no way to know, but yeah.
Separate the salt, fresh water.
Yeah, I don't know, but it's been said. I could read up on that because if you read, you know, the guy who did a lot of this major work in the 50s and 60s was, if you've heard of him, was Henry Morris. And Henry Morris was actually a PhD in hydrology or hydraulics and wrote like unbelievably complicated books on how that worked. But the purpose of God is that I think the oceans are kind of, how could we say it? The ocean is kind of, I mean, we love the ocean. I love the ocean. But the ocean is kind of like the garbage can of the earth. Because whenever you see the earth in a better condition, and then you go to the end of the book, you go to the new heavens and the new earth, John is very careful to say, there's no more sea. So God arranged it so that salt would be there, you know, to contend probably with pollutants and so forth. As to how did it drain out, I don't know, because we don't know at what point does the salt get introduced, like where on the land does it get introduced? Is there a layer under the ground, which is at, you know, as we're making a slope, as we're making the continental slope, is that where it is so that the water gets introduced into the system at that point? It's very interesting that the salinity of the ocean is, it's uniform all over the world. So, you know, so the only places that are a little saltier are the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean Sea, and nobody knows why. So it's an interesting question. I just don't know the answer. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, great question. The question is about when did it become a bad thing to marry your immediate family? I think that, obviously that was something that God allowed out of necessity, because if I could use a non-pulpit word, I think we would all agree that it's icky at any time. Right? But God had to allow it out of necessity so that the human race could be propagated. We talked about this extensively, by the way. If you can go back and listen to it when we talked about Cain and Abel and so forth, because that's a question that always comes up. But certainly after the flood and several generations in the time of Abraham, you see when you see the lifespans dropping down, we're exposed to, you know, stronger radiation that ages us more rapidly, right? We don't live to be 175 anymore like Abraham even. So once you get that level of genetic damage, it certainly becomes extremely dangerous. We are, and you could look it up, I mean, we're not getting any better. If there is such a thing as evolution, we're not evolving into something greater. We're actually devolving. You know, everybody's IQ on the earth is going down. We're all living longer, but that's because, you know, we have, you know, better sanitation and so forth. But you see God setting those fences up in the Torah. So by the time we get to the law of Moses, it is absolutely prohibited to marry certain degrees of kinship, even though the Egyptians did it. And that's why God made such clear boundaries, and that's why there's chapters in the Old Testament that you don't read with your kids, right? Thou shalt not, you know, he that does this, when he shall not look in this one's nakedness and all that. So the reason why those are there is because you had the pagan society of the Egyptians that didn't have those boundaries. Quite the opposite. You know, the Pharaoh was the god of their society, and Pharaoh was, you know, every pharaoh was the product of a marriage to of a brother and a sister. Sometimes if Pharaoh didn't marry his sister, sometimes he married his mother. So if that's your society and that's your God that you look up to, that he's the product of a sibling marriage and he marries his mother, I mean, yuck. So, but if that's the ideal that's held up to you, well, you could imagine anything goes in a society like that. So, so they frequently, and it's still done very often in the Middle East, they frequently marry their cousin. Jews, not so much in the Middle East, but certainly in the Arab cultures. There are some Arab countries where the rate of cousin marriage is like 30-40%. In the Palestinian territories, it may even be like 50-60% cousin marriage.
His first cousin?
Yes. Yes, and it's a huge problem. It's a huge problem in the Middle East, which they do not like to talk about because it reflects poorly on their society. And it's a huge problem for immigrants in that part of the world that are coming into Western Europe, because there's a lot of retardation, there's a lot of other health problems that are caused by that. So it's always been pretty accepted, though, in Western culture to marry your cousin, but certainly not any closer than that. Only in the late 1800s, when they started to figure out the genetics, you know, even before they knew about DNA, what, did there come about this movement in society to ban cousin marriage. So I only know this because, you know, because I was a lawyer, but it used to be the case that, I mean, it is the case today still that some places in the U.S. you can marry your cousin and some cases you can't, because there came about this movement as they realized that, look, This is not a good thing to do, because the level of deformities is twice what it would normally be when you marry your cousin. But, you know, in Connecticut and in New York, it is legal to marry your first cousin. Yes, it is. But the real problem began, Michael, I think, in terms of it being really risky, certainly after the flood, because all of the other health effects and the dropping of the lifespan and all the rest of that, I believe, happened because we lost that water canopy. And so right after the flood, you read it in Abraham's genealogy, you could see those lifespans dropping. I think Abraham's father lived to be 210. You know, none of you is making that, all right? So, hate to disappoint you, but nobody here is breaking the two-century mark. So I think that's the point at which, you know, aside from reasons of propriety, that's the point at which it became truly dangerous. I mean, we just don't have a grid to understand what amazing, you know, near-perfect creations these people were before the flood. I mean, if you have a body that pretty much, you know, can go for 900 years. I mean, can you imagine the mentality that the person has? Can you imagine how well their systems would operate? Every system, their nervous system, digestive system, their immune system. I mean, what kind of shape do you have to be in and your body to live, you know, to be 950? So theoretically, if we're not sitting in this bath of cosmic rays, we could all live to that age. But because we're getting bathed in this, you know, if somebody makes it to be 120, it will be front page news all over the world. We may get there, but, you know, not now. So, anybody else? Yeah.
The Ark of the Plains idea, and the Church
government
saying that they believe that's the Ark. Does that mean that it's going to be a real, I mean,
what is The guy that popularized that was the guy that Indiana Jones is based on. It's a guy named Wendell Jones. He became actually an apostate. He went so far into Hebrew roots thinking that he completely denied Christ, actually. And it's a long story, but he's a very interesting character. But he claimed that there were, you know, there was metal there in those structures, like, you know, indicating beams and so forth. But other people say it's not. It's just, you know, stone structures and things. And they said that he even, like, found things using a divining rod and everything. So there's a lot of controversy about it. But I think it's very appealing to people because, and there's some people that swear by it, that really swear that this is legitimate, that the location matches what the ancient peoples of the region used to say. I've read that until maybe 5 or 6 centuries after the time of Christ, people never said that the Ark was actually on Mount Ararat. They always put it in that region. And the Muslims picked up, I guess, that tradition, which was a Syrian tradition, that that's where it was. So now when you get into the 1940s, there's a mudslide, and this thing comes out. And so people have been arguing about it ever since, but most people, not everybody, but most people say it's just a rock formation. It just happens to be a rock formation in the size of a ship that's 500 feet long. So those are the kinds of things that people go back and forth with, and there's lawsuits, and they write books against each other and everything. So it's very interesting. But I've given you enough there that if you Google some of those names and places, you'll find lots of interesting things. But, you know, Wendell Jones, who was the template for Indiana Jones, he actually apostatized from Christ. And he's a very interesting character. He's passed away now. So, yeah. Anybody else? Interesting stuff, right? So someday we'll find out. All right. Well, God bless you guys.